Now, the next agent provocateur, well, actually, fortunately for us, it was not a successful operation, but the next attempted provocation on behalf of the criminal conspiracy section was truly a monstrous plan, and very significantly here, this involved not only elements of the FBI and CIA, but also apparently elements of the Nixon White House as well, and we're going to take a look at possible connections between this conspiracy and Watergate, indications that perhaps the conspiracy we're about to outline, or the proposed conspiracy, it was fortunately scotched before it had a chance to reach fulfillment, was in fact what Watergate was all about. Quoting again from Lewis Tackwood, the they here, by the way, is the criminal conspiracy section, the people in the glass house. They have an overall plan. You see, like I say, most of them are sergeants from the start. Most of them make money you wouldn't even believe. And their major plan, let me tell you, their major plan is that they want a full police state. I don't just mean California, but all over. They talk about it all the time. Total police state. You see my point? And when they get to the top of the organization, they're saying that whenever it comes, they're going to be number one man, number two man. And I'm going to tell you, they talk about making that big dough. See my point? Plus the prestige of being on the top. I'm saying people who are involved are now looking at the future. Wow, when we do get this police thing, phew, look out. They got a plan working right now. What they're trying to figure out how they can get Nixon to declare martial law. It's in the planning stage right now. He would create martial law, and that would give an excuse to arrest hundreds of people. Hundreds and hundreds. See what I mean? And once they arrest all these people, I'm going to tell you there'd be no stopping it. Even if tomorrow morning you say martial law wasn't in effect, you see my point? They'd still have been out there, and they got control out there now. In other words, like I mean, this would be a police state ever afterwards. So basically what we're talking about here is the formal establishment, as Tackwood said, of a police state or of an overt fascist government.
Continuing...
I was just going to say, what Nip is about to read you next are some details as to how they were going to get Richard Nixon to declare martial law.
Continuing with Tackwood's observations, quote, "There is a plan right now that is so monstrous that it is pathetic. It entails a detailed plan to blow up the Republican convention. It has been worked out by the super agencies at CCS offices with the FBI present, down to the minutest detail. The blame will fall on militant organizations demonstrating in the convention. The president will then be asked to declare a state of national emergency and martial law. Within 48 hours, they will arrest all known militants on the left, and a police state will then exist within the American democratic structure. And when the 48 hours is over, the president will have given over the powers to the police, who will not relinquish that power. In a sense, we will be under total police scrutiny. The super agencies plan to cause a disruption, create a bombing, in other words, a killing, and blame left-wing militants."
Now, the next section of the Glass House tapes we're going to read concerns how the Squad 19 conspiracy, as it eventually was to be called, the plan to blow up the Republican convention in San Diego, blame it on the left, and to use that as an excuse to create martial law in the United States, we're going to take a look at how this was foiled. Basically, to make a long story short, and we're going to provide you with the details here, the criminal conspiracy section, the Citizens Research and Investigating Committee, the CRIC, the co-authors of this book with Tackwood, got together and investigated the allegations of Lewis Tackwood, substantiated them, and then broke them to the mainstream press as well as the underground press. Not only did Tackwood pass a lie detector test on his allegations with flying colors, he also was able to have his story corroborated by three mainstream journalists in addition to CRIC. The journalists are Carl Fleming of Newsweek, Jerry Cohen of the Los Angeles Times, and Leroy Ahrens of the Washington Post. And CRIC described this as follows. "The undercover agent had now surfaced to tell his story to the world. He began a 7-hour marathon interrogation with Fleming, Ahrens, and Cohen. Armed with the material scoured from the hidden corners of Tackwood's past, they took him back over his 10-year career with the precision of good investigators. No detail of his life as an agent was left out. They had names, dates, and places of incidents in Tackwood's past that had been lost in the recesses of his memory. At the end of the 7 hours, the reporters were convinced that there was a big story, perhaps one worth a congressional investigation. They only had to convince their editors to run it, and for that they needed to have Tackwood take a lie detector test. An examination was set up by Cohen with the well-known polygrapher Chris Gugus in Hollywood. Gugus, by the way, is G-U-G-U-S. Tackwood came to Gugus' office accompanied by CRIC members. Gugus was reportedly a trusted professional who had high recommendations. But when CRIC members learned Gugus was an ex-sheriff's officer and noticed the framed autographed picture of Gugus and J. Edgar Hoover, they wondered if they had fallen into a trap. Chris Gugus had more the appearance of a dentist than a polygrapher. He wore a long white smock and horn-rimmed glasses and walked with sort of a cock's strut. He kept a secretary who seemed never to have anything to do. Gugus conducted a preliminary test and decided Tackwood was too high-strung and nervous to go through with the examination at the time. He recommended that he be put up overnight to relax, with a private detective to guard him. The press put up the $100 for the night, and everyone returned home wondering what the results would be the next day. Events began to turn quickly now. CRIC was beginning to have doubts about what press intentions were, and consequently began to move ahead with plans to break the story open to other media. Arrangements were made with KPFK to have a press conference in their studio where it would be broadcast live in Los Angeles and Pacifica's sister stations in Houston, Berkeley, and New York. The polygraph test of Tackwood was held the next day. His allegations were vindicated. Under the curious circumstances, it was difficult to tell who was more surprised, CRIC or the press. Yet all the accusations against CCS and their conspiratorial activities were substantially verified by the polygraph. Perhaps more amazed than anyone was Chris Gugus. He asked Tackwood to return the next day in order that other questions concerning his police work could be gone over in more detail. So the point here being that not only were some mainstream journalists able to confirm Tackwood's story, but he passed a polygraph test with flying colors.
Continuing with the description of the press conference that had been scheduled, the press conference was held as scheduled on November 13th. Tackwood was a virtuoso. There was no going back for him now. The bridges were burned. The story in print was now irreversible. Chief of Police Davis's only statement to the press was, quote, "There has been a Bolshevik trying to plant this story on the police for the last 2 weeks. I didn't think the press would take it seriously," unquote. Tackwood's candid reply was, quote, "What's a Bolshevik?" unquote. The story was run nationwide in the Post and the Los Angeles Times, the left, black, and underground press, radio, and television. Tackwood even made a short newsreel with some private filmmakers. The story was picked up in Europe and Latin America with great interest. It was a media sensation for a week. Skipping down, on November 20th, 1972, Secret Service agents arrived at KPFK to begin an investigation of the San Diego conspiracy. And I think it's highly significant, the use of the phrase, it was a media sensation for a week. One of the things we've talked about on this broadcast, and people who turn these broadcasts on for the first or second time oftentimes have difficulty believing some of the things that we are sharing with the listening audience. But those who wish only need to think back to the House committee that looked into the Kennedy assassination for the second time, realized that that committee, House of Representatives, U.S. Congress, Congressional Committee, came forth with a finding of probable conspiracy in the Kennedy assassination, and basically the nationwide reaction was, so what? As a matter of fact, I believe it was the New York Times that wrote an editorial on its front page that said, okay, so there were two lone nuts in Dealey Plaza. So, again, now the Tackwood story, it's not at all unusual, and it's not at all surprising, and it's all too sad to realize that, as they say, the story was basically a media sensation for about 1 week, and the only people who really seemed to take a lot of notice of it was the Secret Service.
Right. Now, it should be added that there was, in addition to the information already presented, additional information surfaced corroborating Tackwood's stories, the investigations of Fleming, Ahrens, and Cohen, as well as underground journalists, and, the polygraph test, which Tackwood passed. And I think it's also worth noting that some of the people who came forward to corroborate various aspects of Tackwood's story were actually from relatively conservative backgrounds, it's important to distinguish, and a lot of people don't distinguish between a fascist, and we talk about fascism and fascists all the time, and a real conservative. A real conservative is going to be appalled by fascism, and a lot of real conservatives were terribly appalled by the plans of the Nixon White House, the Reagan administration, and the various police and intelligence services to declare martial law and stage this monstrous provocation. Further corroboration of Tackwood's story is contained in the passage I'm about to read you. And very significantly here, there are indications, and this is the part of the discussion we're going to be getting into now, that the Squad 19 conspiracy, what Tackwood was into, the CCS plan to blow up the Republican convention in 1972, was inextricably connected to Watergate. And that basically, when Tackwood came out and in cooperation with CRIC and the journalists, broke the story about this impending provocation, then what simply happened is the convention was switched to Miami, and the types of provocateur to be used were switched. And we're going to look at some intelligent speculation here by CRIC and some interesting coincidences that would indicate that perhaps the Watergate burglars were involved in a lot more than just political espionage, that they may very well have been involved with hiring provocateur to disrupt the Republican convention. They had certainly been involved in hiring provocateur in other situations. Continuing again with the Glasshouse tapes. In the spring of 1970, William Howard, a Washington, D.C. reporter for the conservative Newhouse chain, published a story about a contingency plan to cancel the 1972 elections, unquote, which he claimed he learned about from the wife of a Rand Corporation executive. There was a virtual news blackout on the subject. According to Howard, the president had ordered the Rand Corporation think tank in Santa Monica, California, to do a feasibility study, unquote, of the cancellation possibility in 1972 because of Nixon's concern about possible disruption by the left. The Wall Street Journal wrote April 24, 1970, rumors that the study had been ordered were hard to spike, unquote. The Los Angeles Free Press picked up the story and was told privately by persons at Rand that it, quote, had done a good and right thing in publishing the story, unquote. We now come to Tackwood's strange San Diego conspiracy. This weird scenario became known to the world as the Watergate affair. Quoting again directly from the Glasshouse tapes themselves. I'm not going to show CRIC. I'm not telling nobody all what I got on Squad 19 on the San Diego conspiracy. But I'm going to show you some of it since it's starting to come out anyway. But I'm not giving up everything because, man, this is my only life insurance. You see where I'm coming from? I'm giving up only two names. There's Martin and there's White. All right, now Martin was the code name for my contact, and I'm going to tell you he's CIA all the way. Are you ready for this? He was in Dallas when they got Kennedy. He left out of there for the Caribbean, and Martin is in on the cancellation of the election some way, and in on the concentration camp thing. Do you see what I'm saying? Now the control, the man over Martin, is White. I only heard a little about him, but they say he's the money man. Nobody's over him but the top dogs. Martin and White. That's all I'm going to give you now. This is my life insurance. 8 months after that tape was made by Lewis E. Tackwood, two mystery men were catapulted into the headlines. Their names were McCord and Hunt. Their various code names included Martin and White. These names were used by several operatives. The Watergate affair began on June 17, 1972, with the arrest of five men in the Democratic National Committee offices located in the Watergate Hotel, Washington, D.C., the home of John and Martha Mitchell. A $1 million suit was placed against the Committee for the Re-election of the President for compensatory and punitive damages to the Democratic headquarters. Charges in the suit may include unlawful interception of wire communications, as well as unlawful possession of wire devices and burglary. And I would add here that this book came out in 73, the year in which the Watergate story broke. James McCord wrote his letter to Judge Sirica, which precipitated the public airing of the story, or as much of it as did get aired publicly, in March of 73. So the Watergate case really had not broken as such when this book came out, and that's worth noting here, because the scenario being presented here by CRIC was really before the public as a whole knew about Watergate. Now again, Martin and White were the name of Tackwood's contacts, linked to the Kennedy assassination, the quote concentration camp thing, as Tackwood referred to it, namely the overt plan to turn the United States for all intents and purposes into a fascist country and establish martial law. And we're going to go on here and take a look at CRIC's further discussion concerning the Squad 19 conspiracy at Watergate.
Continuing with the CRIC's explanations, what was actually happening at the Democratic National Convention headquarters, and of course they're referring to at the time of the bugging, that was the precipitating agent for what we know as Watergate. Electronic devices were involved, but that seems to be the least serious activity. Within 6 weeks of the first arrest, it was known that at least 12 men and $114,000 were involved. This was obviously not a, quote, bugging budget or squad. The invaders were discovered putting forged documents of some kind in files, not taking papers out. They were not burglars. These were only the first major contradictions. The men, wearing evening clothes and rubber gloves, carried electronic devices so sophisticated that, according to the New York Daily News, they could have been used for, quote, months without detection. These veteran clandestine operatives are the same men that sources close to the White House called, quote, circus tramps and burglars. Also, in the team's possession were, quote, incendiary and bomb manufacturing devices and implements, according to the Washington police. They had previously planted a super-sensitive listening device in a fire alarm box. The men had been in the Democratic Committee offices before, and the listening devices were still working. In fact, as they broke and entered, another team of agents was dismantling a listening post in a motel across the street from the Watergate complex. One thing was perfectly clear. This espionage mission was involved with far more than eavesdropping. As the investigation of the event unfolded during the 1972 presidential campaign, it became clear that Watergate was but the tip of the iceberg. Hundreds of thousands of dollars and scores of men were revealed as part of a national network for political espionage, sabotage, and provocation. The contacts for the provocateurs, who were then recruited, turned out to be men from the White House, some of the president's closest advisors. Well, as we will see in a moment, they were some of the president's closest advisors, and the partial unearthing of Watergate caused the downfall of the presidency of Richard Nixon. However, even we do not know the full story today, and obviously the full story was not known at the time of this book was being written, as Dave mentioned, it was published in 1973, Watergate was undoubtedly a more complicated affair than we have been shown so far. The fact that Watergate itself would have virtually disappeared had it not been for the fact that James McCord, one of the aforementioned Martin and Smith duo, along with E. Howard Hunt, got a sudden attack of conscience on the as the case was falling apart against he and Hunt and the rest of them, and wrote a letter to Judge John Sirica, basically blowing the whistle and setting the whole thing up. Some people have suggested that McCord's act was, in essence, the delayed fuse for a CIA attempt to push the Nixon administration out of office for some reason, or at least to put pressure on the Nixon administration. There are a variety of suggestions that have been proffered having to do with Nixon's and Lawrence O'Brien, the Democratic National Commission chairman. Lawrence O'Brien's connections along with Nixon's connections to Howard Hughes. The real thing, though, that is obvious, and we will see it again a little bit more in a moment, is that Watergate was not merely the act of a bunch of Republican politicians trying to bug the Democratic headquarters to find out what the Democrats were going to say in their speech that night.
Now, of course, one of the aspects of the Kennedy assassination that we've discussed, or one of the aspects of Watergate, I should say, that we've discussed in the past, concerns the intersection, the massive intersection between the people involved in the both investigation of and cover-up of the assassination of President Kennedy and Watergate. In our Guns of November series, we did Guns of November number 3 in large part about the connections between Watergate and the Kennedy assassination. So the indications that the Squad 19 conspiracy may have been at the root of Watergate, and that this the planned provocation was simply switched from San Diego to Miami pursuant to Tackwood's allegations, is intriguing in light of the fact that Tackwood mentioned that his control was, quote, in Dallas the day they got Kennedy, unquote. Remember that, and we're going to proceed with more interesting information concerning Watergate and the indications, well, the certainty that the Watergate burglars had been involved in far more than just political espionage. As indicated in the passage Nip just read you, the Watergate burglars were putting things into the files in the Democratic headquarters, not taking them out. In addition, they had incendiary devices, which remains to be seen what they were going to do with those incendiary devices, but the speculation has been that they were going to try and link these leftist provocations to the Democratic Party as a whole. And again, there are a lot of indications that had the burglars not been arrested inside the Watergate Hotel, that some sort of massive provocation would have taken place at the Miami Convention, at the Republican 1972 Convention. Returning again to the Glasshouse tapes. Here is what can be reconstructed so far. Howard Hunt resigns from the CIA and is hired by the White House at the behest of Robert C. Odle, Jr., an assistant in 1960 to both John Mitchell and Richard Kleindienst. Setting aside speculations about those over Hunt, we can trace Hunt as he contacts James McCord, who, according to the Washington Post, headed a Pentagon unit, quote, that develops lists of radicals and draws up contingency plans for the censorship of the news media and the U.S. mail, unquote. McCord is employed by several GOP committees. His take-home salary is $1,209 a month. McCord had received some $3,000 extra for equipment purchased. The radios the team had when arrested were licensed exclusively to the Republican National Committee. Hunt also contacted his old subordinate from the 1961 CIA Cuban adventure, Bernard Barker. Barker shares offices with Miguel R. Suarez, a Cuban exile lawyer prominent in Republican politics in Florida, who the New York Times of June 19, 1972 connects to former Governor Claude Kirk of Florida. If we follow the force of the worm's eye view of Tackwood's revelations, we now have the following scenario. When the Tackwood revelations and the ITT scandal forced the GOP convention switch to Miami, Cubans replaced blacks, Chicanos, and Jesus freaks as provocateur, but the new team would still be run, unquote, from Washington, D.C. by White and Martin. The clandestine operation. The committee to re-elect the president sets aside massive amounts of money for, quote, intelligence gathering and other steps to prevent disruptions of the Republican National Convention, unquote, the Washington Post reports. Nine men, all registered with false names taken from spy novels written by Howard Hunt, Jr., stayed at the Watergate Hotel May 26th through 29th, and again June 17th through 18th. All of the five men caught in the Democratic headquarters were connected with the CIA in some way. The other relationship they had in common was having worked together for the CIA-planned Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba.
Continuing with the Glasshouse tapes, considering the Tackwood allegations that were made public in October of 1971, McCord's job, it's James McCord, of course, McCord's job of maintaining security at the conventions was equal to securing the electoral process. Bernard Barker was telling people in Miami that, quote, something was going to happen at the time of the conventions, unquote. He was busy planning demonstrations in approval of Nixon's bombing of the Haiphong harbors. On April 24th, Barker and a secret team of seven men went to Miami to hire provocateurs for a New York demonstration. Four of this team were arrested at the Watergate Hotel. Three were in Miami at the time, and one left the country because he was, quote, headed for trouble. There were plans for a May demonstration that was moved to Washington, D.C. after J. Edgar Hoover's death. Paid demonstrators were hired to make an ugly scene while Hoover's body was lying in state. Money to pay for street scenes and fights with police and radicals came from the same money man, Bernard Barker, who served as the conduit of funds for the Bay of Pigs invasion. This time, Barker was handing out crisp, consecutive $100 bills that came to Miami's Republican National Bank from a secret source in Mexico via a secret source in Chile. James McCord, chief of security for the Republican National Committee, was paid for the Watergate job with the same funds that hired street altercations. Barker's wife said that her husband had not been active with the Cuban community for 5 years. She was surprised he was arrested working with that group again. That observation fits in with the Squad 19 plan, which was arranged for San Diego. When the convention was moved to Miami, a whole new group of street people would have to set the milieu for confrontations. Some persons could be imported. Local varieties would be better. The radical, emotional, well-trained, constantly provoked Cuban exile community could be worked up sufficiently with enough of those CIA $100 bills floating around again. One man in Miami was offered $700, quote, CIA money to demonstrate on the streets in August for the conventions. Kenneth H. Dahlberg, Nixon's campaign finance chairman for the Midwest, turned a check for $25,000 over to, quote, Maurice Stans himself, the former Secretary of Commerce. That check, plus another $100,000, was then deposited to the account of Bernard L. Barker, the Cuban conduit for the affair. Barker handed out $30,000 to the Watergate men for hotel expenses and elaborate equipment. $10,000 went to the Washington May Day provocations. Frank Sturgis was planning demonstrations for the Republican conventions. Two private Catholic colleges received a call from Sturgis asking for, quote, lodging in August for young Republicans. He left his phone number at Bernard Barker's real estate office. Sturgis also called Berry College, said he was, quote, an organizer and wanted rooms for 200 places. Where were these young Republicans coming from? Douglas Caddy, attorney for the men arrested, was co-founder of Young Americans for Freedom. That group is infiltrated with radicals, extremists, and many who supported Agnew for president. Eugenio Martinez, real estate partner of Barker, was making his own reservations to bring in about 3,000 young Republicans for convention time. Depending upon the background, training, beliefs of a paramilitary, religious, violently anti-communist element, there is no way of telling if Martinez, Gonzalez, Barker, and Sturgis were planning to import trouble. If they hired provocateurs for the May demonstrations in Washington, who were they making these reservations for in August?
Okay, now, that concludes the portion of our broadcast where, in which we're going to deal with the book The Glass House Tapes and the various conspiracies detailed within it.
Alrighty, and that does indeed conclude our examination of the San Diego or Squad 19 conspiracy, something which may very well have been directly connected to the Watergate scandal proper. Certainly, the Squad 19 or San Diego conspiracy was among the nastiest things that Richard Nixon's milieu and Richard Nixon personally undertook. This particular conspiracy never actually came off. But we should note that the martial law contingency plans, which emerged into public view during the Iran-Contra scandal, and which apparently remain on the books to this day, date back to this period of time, specifically back to Operation Garden Plot and Cable Splicer, programs instituted by Richard Nixon in which state and local police worked with the federal intelligence agencies and the military to frustrate or destroy the anti-Vietnam War movement and the black and brown power movements, in particular here in California. We are examining Richard Nixon's political resume, or some significant aspects of it that have not received the attention they warrant, because, as I stated at the beginning of the broadcast this evening, what is really important about Richard Nixon is not the individual acts of Richard Nixon, but rather the political forces that created him and the political forces of which he was a part in turn. And what we're going to do now is to examine that milieu, or attempt to examine that milieu. Once again, we're going to stick with, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, and specifically we're going to be taking a look at the operations of, among others, anti-Castro Cubans trained by the CIA and working on behalf of the Nixon White House. Only this time we're going to be taking a look ever so briefly at their activities to, quote, control, unquote, the narcotics traffic, although they were supposedly engaged in eliminating the heroin trade. There is substantive evidence that, in fact, the intelligence community and the drug enforcement machinery of the federal government, including anti-Castro Cubans with CIA backgrounds working for a fellow, a veteran CIA and OSS operative named Lucian Conine, who was working on behalf of the Nixon drug enforcement machinery. There are indications that, in fact, that milieu and that machinery was used to redirect control over the international heroin trade from the Corsican milieu, the so-called French connection, to the Latin American and Southeast Asian political allies of Richard Milhouse Nixon. We're going to turn for our information to a book which is one of the mainstays of One Step Beyond. It's a book which has been entered into the archive shows on numerous occasions. And that book is The Great Heroin Coup, authored by freelance Danish journalist Henrik, H-E-N-R-I-K, Kruger, K-R-U, umlaut, G-E-R. That book is subtitled Drugs, Intelligence, and International Fascism. It's copyrighted 1980 and published in both hard and soft cover by the Southend Press of Boston. The book has an excellent foreword by Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley professor, and it is, for my money, the best single book about the intelligence narcotics connection to come out to date, although there are others that have come out since. Again, this book is copyrighted 1980, so it's quite old. In a recent phone-in session to this program, someone asked if there was one particular book that one could read to get an understanding of this material, or as good an understanding as possible. There's no one book that people can read, but if one were to pick a single book, the great heroin coup merits serious consideration. What we're going to look at is a section of the foreword by Professor Peter Dale Scott, in which he sums up the basic working hypothesis of the great heroin coup, the title section of this book, namely that Richard Nixon's use of anti-Castro Cubans with CIA backgrounds and the drug enforcement machinery in general of the federal government to shut down the Corsican heroin connection into the United States, that this basically was an attempt not to eliminate the heroin traffic into the United States, but to redirect it. And this scenario, and there, although it has never been absolutely confirmed, has a great deal of credible information indicating that it is, in fact, valid. By the way, we go into the great heroin coup at considerable length in Radio Free America program number 26. So the number 26, and also to a certain extent number 27, go into the great heroin coup proper, that aspect of this book. Turning to the foreword to this book, now what we're going to do now is examine, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, and we're going to dolly back, in a sense, and gain a wider angle view, because in looking at the milieu which surrounded, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, or as Henry Kruger later terms it, the Miami conspiracy, not the Bay of Pigs, but rather the conspiratorial milieu that surrounded Miami and incorporates, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, we're looking at a political milieu and an explicitly fascist political milieu, which not only dictated the political fortunes of Richard Nixon, he was inextricably linked with that milieu, but that milieu continues to wreak havoc to this day. It is, in my opinion, the dominant political milieu in the world today, and it is explicitly fascist, and it winds its way through history, even past the history of Richard Nixon's administrations, right on up through the Cuban terrorist organizations such as Alpha 66 and Omega 7 and Kuru, right on up to the mid-1970s, on up through the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Bush, the Iran-Contra scandal, and events which continue to unfold to this day. We turn now to Peter Dale Scott's foreword for the Great Heroin Coup. Many writers have since suggested that Nixon's war on heroin was part of his, quote, grand design, unquote, to develop a new drug superagency under direct White House control into, quote, the strong investigative arm for domestic surveillance that President Nixon had long quested after, unquote. Yet the establishment press failed to look critically at Nixon's war on heroin. Instead, it blandly reported Nixon's decision in June of 1971 to provide $100 million in aid to end opium production in Turkey, a country which, according to CIA estimates, produced only 3 to 8% of the illicit opium available throughout the world. At the time, perhaps 80% of the world's illicit opium was grown, much of it by CIA-supported tribesmen in the, quote, Golden Triangle, unquote, of Laos, Burma, and Thailand, while the Shah of Iran, who became one of Nixon's closest foreign allies, had just announced resumption of Iranian opium production of over 20,000 hectares, an area 50% greater than the total cultivation in Turkey. As the New Republic noted only 1 month later, Nixon's decision to shut down the supply of Turkish opium was, quote, likely to do no more than drive the industry further east, unquote. And note that at this particular time, 80% of the world's illicit opium was being grown in the Golden Triangle, much of it by CIA-supported tribesmen. Continuing with Peter Dale Scott's introduction. Another, and even more cynical view of Nixon's action is to see it as a direct attack on the French Corsican networks, which relied almost exclusively on Turkey as their supply, as their source of supply, and which, according to Le Monde, are being deliberately forced out of the international drug trade as the result of a, quote, close mafia, police, narcotics bureau collaboration, unquote. Le Monde stated explicitly that it was the U.S. Sicilian Mafia which closed down the sluice gates of Turkish opium production. Was Nixon personally playing a role, as Henrik Kruger suggests, in this seamy international drug war between rival networks? Such a possibility seems less remote when we recall the rivalry which had grown up in the 1960s between de Gaulle's intelligence services and the CIA, and the respective reliance of these services upon the rival Corsican and U.S.-Italian crime syndicates. Le Monde had no difficulty in spelling out the American side of the intelligence mafia connection, even though the CIA activities of Santos Traficante, the alleged heir to the Luciano network, were not known to it at the time. Quote, instructed by his own experience of collaboration with the American intelligence services, Lucky Luciano used to recommend to his honorable correspondents scattered from Beirut to Tangiers via Ankara and Marseille to operate as he had done. It was in this way that drug dealers and couriers served as informants to the British MI5, to the American CIA, to the French SDECE, to the West German Galen Organization, even to the Italian CIFAR, S-I-F-F-A-R. On the French side, Le Monde was predictably more reticent, but from other sources we learned that at least two members of the competing Ricord network, Christian David and Michel Nicoli, N-I-C-O-L-I, were former members of the Gaullist Service d'Action Civique, or SAC, the parallel police or Barbouz, B-A-R-B-O-U-Z-E-S, who had been used to assassinate members of the right-wing Organisation de l'Armée Secrète, or OAS, in revolt against de Gaulle's accommodation with Algeria. Through SAC, David and Nicoli had come into contact with SDECE operations as well. One of the major theses, and this is where the basic thesis of the title coup, the Great Heroin Coup, is stated, one of the major theses of Henry Kruger's fascinating book is that, quote, the Great Heroin Coup, unquote, the, quote, remarkable shift, unquote, from Marseille, Corsican, to Southeast Asian and Mexican mafia heroin in the United States, was a deliberate move to reconstruct and redirect the heroin trade rather than to eliminate it, and that Cuban exiles, Santo Traficante, the CIA, and the Nixon White House were all involved. One more time. One of the major theses of Henry Kruger's fascinating book is that, quote, the Great Heroin Coup, unquote, the, quote, remarkable shift, unquote, from Marseille, Corsican, to Southeast Asian and Mexican mafia heroin in the United States was a deliberate move to reconstruct and redirect the heroin trade rather than to eliminate it, and that Cuban exiles, Santo Traficante, the CIA, and the Nixon White House were all involved. Then quoting a section of Henrik Kruger's actual text, it was, needless to say, not a willful conspiracy of all of the above. But we can assert with reasonable certainty that the CIA, Traficante, and other mafiosi, certain Southeast Asians, and some people in the White House must have been in the know. Unquote. And going on with Scott's introduction, as Kruger tells the story, the motivations for the alleged heroin coup were primarily political. To break the power of the old Gaullist SAC connection, which by 1970 was as distasteful to de Gaulle's pro-American successor Pompidou as it was to Nixon, and on the American side to replace it by an alternative power base. In Kruger's analysis, it was not so much a struggle between the French and American intelligence services, SDECE and CIA, as it was a struggle between old and new leaderships. The coming to power of Pompidou in France and of Nixon in America had created unprecedented tensions and suspicions between these two presidents and their old-line intelligence services. Hence, Nixon's desire to use the war on heroin as a pretext for a new super-agency under White House control. Hence, also, the successive agreements between Nixon, Pompidou, and their cabinet officers to crack down on the old Corsican connection. Well, Henry Kruger's hypothesis, as I say, has a great deal to support it. It has never been etched in stone, and obviously is, to a certain extent at least, open to interpretation. But certainly the milieu of Watergate, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, is inextricably linked with the world of narcotics. And indeed, Richard Nixon's political fortunes were inextricably linked not only with the intelligence community and organized crime, but as we shall see, and to a certain extent have already seen, with international fascism. Richard Nixon was certainly no stranger either to organized crime or to the heroin trade. We saw his curious behavior as an attorney for PepsiCo, the parent company of Pepsi-Cola, in his activities in Dallas, Texas, on from November 20th through November 22nd of 1963. Nixon claimed he left on November 20th of 63, even though he left on the 22nd, a couple of hours before Kennedy was assassinated. This despite the fact, of course, as we have seen, that the New York Times of 11-22-63 carried a UPI interview with Nixon on November 21st of 63, a day after he told the FBI he left town. Another of Richard Nixon's interesting activities as an attorney for PepsiCo was to lobby very heavily for the establishment of a Pepsi-Cola bottling plant in Vientiane, Laos, and that plant was subsidized by funding from the U.S. Agency for International Development. However, that plant never bottled a single bottle of Pepsi-Cola, What it did become was one of the largest heroin refineries in all of Southeast Asia. Speaking of that, Henry Kruger writes in The Great Heroin Coup, among the largest was one in Vientiane, Laos, which was camouflaged as a Pepsi-Cola plant. Nixon, representing Pepsi's interests in 1965, had promoted its construction. Though the plant never capped a bottle, it continued to be subsidized by the agency, by the USAID, or U.S. Agency for International Development. What we're going to look at next is the evolution of the, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing. And by that I mean not specifically the Kennedy assassination or the Bay of Pigs or Watergate, but rather the milieu. And it is not just American, it is international, but the milieu of which Richard Nixon was an integral part, and the milieu which in turn created Richard Nixon and many who have come after. For indeed, the importance of understanding Richard Nixon as a political animal is to understand the forces that created him and the forces, again, of which he was a part. Because even though Richard Nixon is no longer with us, those forces are indeed the forces, in my opinion, that dominate the world at this time. They are explicitly fascist. They were the forces underlying Ronald Reagan and George Bush. And barring drastic changes, they are going to continue to wield the stick of power and do so with a very, very harsh hand. In a chapter, and by the way, all of the material that I've read so far is in various other archive shows. The Great Heroin Coup specifically is covered in Radio Free America 26 and 27. What we're going to look at next is what Henry Kruger has termed the Miami Conspiracy, namely the milieu of which Nixon, the Bay of Pigs, the Kennedy assassination, the Great Heroin Coup, the Squad 19 conspiracy, and much which has come after, the milieu of which all of those elements are a part. Henry Kruger writes in The Great Heroin Coup, saying, Miami is the center of a huge conspiratorial milieu whose personnel wind through the Bay of Pigs, attempts on Castro's life, the JFK murder, and the Great Heroin Coup, which is now reaching out with a vengeance to Latin America and Europe. To trace the roots of this milieu, we must refer to the immediate aftermath of World War II, when the CIA began its close cooperation with Adolf Hitler's espionage chief, Reinhard Gehlen, and the Soviet general Andrei Vlasov, V-L-A-S-S-O-V, of Russia's secret anti-communist spy network. Vlasov's organization was absorbed into Galen's, which evolved into a European subsidiary of the CIA. U.S. and German agents mingled in Berlin and West Germany, paving the way for inroads into U.S. intelligence by former Nazis, SS agents, and Russian czarists. Headquarters of the CIA Galen-Vlasov Combine, staffed in the mid-50s by 4,000 full-time agents, were in Pulak, P-U-L-L-A-C-H, near Munich. There, Galen sang to the tune of more than one piper, having remained in touch with the old Nazi hierarchy relocated in Latin America, whose coordinator, Otto Skorzeny, was in Spain. By the way, Skorzeny's last name is S-K-O-R-Z-E-N-Y. Skorzeny had infiltrated the Spanish intelligence agency, DGS, and effectively controlled it single-handedly. With the onset of the Cold War, Galen's agents were recruited by the CIA for assignments in the United States, Latin America, and Africa. One agent reportedly was Frank Bender, allegedly alias Fritz Svend, S-W-E-N-D, a key figure in the Bay of Pigs invasion. U.S. historian Carl Oglesby sees the origin of much of the CIA's later sinister record in the alliances it forged almost immediately upon its birth with the Galen-Vlasov organization and, through Operation Underworld, with the Lansky Crime Syndicate. Quote, everything after this, the Galen Alliance on top of Operation Underworld, was probably just a consequence of this merger. How can a naive, trusting, democratic republic give its secrets to crime and its innermost ear to the spirit of Central European fascism and expect not to see its constitution polluted, its traditions abused, and its consciousness of the surrounding world manipulated ultimately out of all realistic shape? Unquote. Kruger goes on, well put. Moreover, it is ironical that Europe's contribution to U.S. fascism is now returning home and threatening the continent in a conspiracy supported by U.S. economic and clandestine forces. The forces Oglesby speaks of were united during and after the Bay of Pigs affair, and their bedfellows were big businessmen with their own private interests. The merger was toasted in Miami.